Browning, Poe, Tennyson, Longfellow, Kipling, Bliss Carman, Lowell, Stevenson, Allingham, and Leopold Wagner were more to his taste, and he had spent many enjoyable hours in their literary company. He had read aloud to his children, and often finished afterwards to myself, the stories of Hans Christian Andersen, the Brothers Grimm, and Howard Pyle. As for Joel Chandler Harris, I would be willing to rest all I have done in the South as regards the Negro in his story, Free Joe. 5 o'clock came and went in Cologne, without any word of a disturbance in Panama City. The cable and railroad offices prepared to shut down for the night. Commander Hubbard came ashore again from the Nashville, and heard with concern that Shaler was resigned to transporting the government battalion in the morning. But before he could object, at 5:49 p.m., a call came through from Herbert G. Prescott, Shaler's deputy at the Pacific Terminus. Strangely, Prescott wanted to speak to Chief Melendez. His message was a coded one, indicating that Prescott, too, was an agent of the junta, and saying that the revolution was about to begin. Subsequent calls made clear that General Tovar and his senior staff had already been arrested at the order of General Huertas. Governor Obaldía was next, surrendering with the utmost equanimity, and by 6 p.m. the junta had started reorganizing itself as a provisional government. Its official documents and proclamations showed that the elderly Dr. Amador held little real power. The executive signatures were always those of José Agustín Arango, Federico Boyd, and Tomás Arias. One of their first official acts was to send Shaler a telegram, warning him in the strongest terms not to accede to any request for transportation of the Tiradores. This act would be of grave consequences for the company you represent. Kenneth Graham, Somerville and Ross, Conrad, Artemus Ward, Octave Thanet, Viljohn, Stevens, Pierre, Burroughs, Swetnam, Gray, Janvier, London, Fox, Garland, Tarkington, Churchill, Remington, Wister, White, Trevelyan. By the time Roosevelt tired of jotting, he had listed 114 author names. Of course, I have forgotten a great many. His catalog did not strike him as impressive. About as interesting, he concluded, as Homer's catalog of the ships. He dozed off several times as the train raced south. Night fell, the weather was still mild and clear, democratic weather. Faceless stations whizzed by in the dark. Sooner than expected, Washington loomed ahead. At 8:14, he alighted at 6th Street Station. A reporter pushed an election dispatch into his hand. He stopped and read it under the bright platform lights. The Republican Party had suffered a landslide defeat in New York. Refusing comment, Roosevelt shook hands with the locomotive crew, then climbed into a waiting White House carriage. It rolled down Pennsylvania Avenue past the Evening Star and Post buildings, only half noticed by crowds peering up at giant, illuminated stereopticon screens. Preliminary polling figures alternated with celebrity portraits and comic, moving pictures. By 9 o'clock, Roosevelt had arrived in the West Wing telegraph room to check on further results, but Loomis was there with a cable that drove all thoughts of the election from his mind. It was Vice Consul Ehrman's nervous message of 5 hours before. Now Ehrman cabled again. Uprising occurred tonight, 6. No bloodshed. Army and Navy officials taken prisoners. Government will be organized tonight, consisting of 3 consuls, also cabinet. Supposed same movement will be effected in Cologne. Order prevails so far. Situation serious. 400 soldiers landed today. Barranquilla. Roosevelt sent at once for his top State and Navy Department aides. Hay arrived within minutes, accompanied by Loomis. Moody was still out of town, so his second-in-command, Charles H. Darling, came instead, followed by Admiral Taylor, chief of the Bureau of Navigation, and 2 assistant officers. A crisis conference began in the president's office. Ehrman's no bloodshed was good news, and Arango, Boyd, and Arias seemed to be going about their business efficiently so far. But the presence of those soldiers in Cologne was indeed serious, and would look even more so when Roosevelt found out that there were 500, not 4. The Nashville was so far the only American presence on either side of the isthmus. Hubbard's guns and Marines might, or might not, be enough to stop the government battalion from crossing over and quashing the revolution. All the more reason, therefore, to keep Tovar's troops on the Caribbean side. But reason of a legal nature must be found in the Treaty of 1846. Roosevelt was aware that early in his own presidency, the State Department had blocked a shipment of rebel arms along the railroad, on the ground that they might be used to prevent further transport of anything. Could the same scruple now justify blocking a shipment of government soldiers, whose only mission was to maintain the integrity of the Colombian Federation? Apparently, it could. Roosevelt authorized a draft set of instructions for the Navy Department to set in cipher and cable immediately. For Nashville, in the interests of peace, do everything possible to prevent government troops from proceeding to Panama City. The transit must be kept open and order maintained. Direct the Atlanta to proceed with all speed to Cologne. Also, the Boston to Panama City. Repeat all of yesterday's orders. Remarkable in this document was its lack of any reference to the strict neutrality imposed upon American commanders in earlier Isthmian crises. By 10:30 p.m., the specific order to Commander Hubbard was ready for transmission and signed by Hay. Further cables went to the other ships involved, although their urgency was largely symbolic. The Atlanta had to finish stoking up in Kingston before it could join the Nashville. The Boston had not yet cleared Honduras. The rest of the Pacific Squadron would need 3 more days to get to Panama City. At least the Dixie was nearing Cologne, where Hubbard could doubtless use it. Up Pennsylvania Avenue, the Stereopticon watchers were roaring as result after result flickered onto the screens. Mayor Seth Lowe of New York City had conceded defeat. A Democratic rout was announced in Maryland. Especially loud cheers, around 11 o'clock, signaled a triumph for Hanna Republicans in Ohio. The White House conference broke up 15 minutes later after another cable from Panama City announced that a government gunboat had tossed 5 or 6 shells into the city, killing a Chinaman in Salsapuedes Street and mortally wounding an ass. If that was the extent of Colombia's rage so far, a tired president could get some sleep. The big word, revolution, crowded election results on the right-hand side of the front page of the Washington Post the next morning. Most other newspapers, however, treated the story from Panama City as if it were the final, entirely predictable installment of a serial that had begun well but lost its power of suspense. In any case, the New York World had given away the ending nearly 4 months before, even forecasting yesterday's date. This temporary lack of interest, the story being by no means over, enabled Roosevelt, Hay, Loomis, and Darling to concentrate on the worsening crisis in Cologne. Commander Hubbard, by triple authority of the White House and the State and Navy Departments, had issued a denial of rail transport to the Tiradores. They were free to march across the isthmus, if they liked, on a mud trail 2 feet wide through one of the wettest jungles in the world. Hubbard informed Colonel Shaler in writing that any redistribution of troops, loyal or revolutionary, must bring about a conflict and threaten that free and uninterrupted transit of the isthmus which the government of the United States is pledged to maintain. He had sent an early copy of this order to Colonel Torres, emphasizing that it applied to both sides and trusting in his cordial cooperation. Torres reacted with cordial fury. He was still unaware of what had happened in Panama City, but he had grown increasingly nervous since the departure of his commanding officers. Their silence was suspicious, as was Hubbard's cryptic reference to a possible conflict. Did the commander mean a clash with insurrectos inland, or an international battle right here on the Cologne waterfront? Torres knew only that an American naval officer was denying him the right to cross his own country. The mid-morning train from Panama City arrived, bringing the first unofficial news of yesterday's uprising. Porfirio Melendez offered to buy Torres a drink. Under soothing fans at the Astor Hotel, he confirmed that Panama had seceded from Colombia. The New Republic's security had been guaranteed by the United States, which was sending more warships. General Tovar was in jail, along with his fellow officers, and so was Governor Obaldia. All Panamanians supported the revolution, so resistance was entirely useless. If Colonel Torres would be so good as to order his men to surrender their arms, the junta would provide rations and passage back to Barranquilla. Torres went into a frenzy to the prefect of Cologne and told him to deliver an ultimatum to Consul Malmros. Unless Tovar and Amaya were freed by 2 p.m., he would open fire on the town and kill every U.S. citizen in the place. When Commander Hubbard heard of this threat, shortly after 1 o'clock, he took it as tantamount to war against the United States. All male Americans in Cologne were ordered to take cover in Shaler's Stone Depot, while their women and children were rushed aboard steamers in the harbor. 42 heavily armed Marines simultaneously came ashore to defend the railroad, while the Nashville patrolled the waterfront. Its guns covered the town at boardwalk level. Undeterred, Torres's 500 men surrounded the railroad yard. In Washington, the president lunched with Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, one of the most interesting men I have ever met, and Sir Frederick Pollock, professor of jurisprudence at Oxford University. Roosevelt enjoyed their company, yet remained temperamentally unable to understand the workings of minds more concerned with reason than power. In New York, Philippe Bonavarria decoded a cable from his friend Smith in Panama City. It was not, as he expected, his appointment as the New Republic's minister plenipotentiary, but a pressing demand for 100,000 pesos. He decided to send half that amount. 50,000 pesos equaled about $25,000, or one quarter of his total pledge. If junta members wanted the rest, they would have to make good on the ministership and certify that they held both coasts. The United States was not likely to dig a canal on only one side of the continental divide. "With all the insistence possible," he cabled back, "I recommend you to seize Cologne." Colonel Torres, closeted with Chief Melendez, let his 2 p.m. deadline pass. For another hour and a quarter, Colombians and Americans continued to draw beads on each other across the railroad yard. The tension increased as the Cartagena, which had raised anchor after the Nashville lowered its guns, steamed toward the horizon at a speed suggesting she sought safety beyond it. Now that they had lost their troop ship, the Tiradores were more than ever compelled to stand and fight. Then Torres approached the depot, smiling. Evidently there had been some pecuniary progress in his negotiations with Chief Melendez. He told Colonel Hubbard that he now felt most friendly toward the United States, but he needed an authorization from his captive leader before he called off his men. Colonel Shaler undertook to transport a pair of Colombian envoys to Panama City for that purpose, and Commander Hubbard promised them safe conduct. After their special train had pulled off, Torres and Hubbard agreed to a mutual, modified fallback. The Marines would retire to the Nashville, and the battalion would camp on a hill outside town, while Cologne would be left under the control of Chief Melendez. A state of unnatural calm settled over the shabby little port, even as Panama City, where the first revolutionary bonuses had just been paid out in silver, abandoned itself to wild celebrations. In Bogota, mobs raged through the streets and stoned President Barraquin's house. And in Washington, Roosevelt and Hay worried over a cable from Malmros. Panama in possession of committee with consent of entire population. Cologne in the possession of the government. And in New York, a naval emissary boarded a steamer of the Panama Railroad Company with a secret package addressed to the commander-in-chief of the North Atlantic Fleet. It contained war plans for an emergency occupation of the isthmus. Colonel Hubbard went ashore early on Thursday, 5 November, to find the Tiradores, rendered irritable by mosquito bites, about to re-enter town. Torres said he had to be ready for the orders of General Tovar, due when his envoys arrived on the mid-morning train. Hubbard, infuriated, once more landed Marines, mounted cannons around the depot, and sent American women and children to safety. The Nashville resumed its sweep of the waterfront. To popular relief, the envoys brought no orders, written or oral, from General Tovar. He declined to command from the depths of a jail cell. He merely expressed confidence that Colonel Torres would always do his duty. Chief Melendez, scenting capitulation, reappeared at Torres's elbow. The colonel blustered bravely all day. Then, shortly before sunset, he agreed to accept an indemnity of $8,000, advanced by Colonel Shaler. The money was counted out in cash. For another $1,000 credit, guaranteed by Colonel Hubbard, the captain of the Royal Mail Company steamship Orinoco agreed to transport the Tiradores home. Torres plotted aboard with his sacks of American gold. 460 men and 13 women followed him up the gangplank. Shaler sent a farewell gift of 2 cases of champagne. Just then, at 7:05 p.m., the Dixie arrived in Colon Harbor. It docked rapidly, undeterred by a violent rainstorm, and disgorged 400 Marines. But their services were not needed. The Orinoco was already underway, and the Panamanian flag rose above Casa Melendez. Roosevelt's cabinet meeting on the morning of Friday, 6 November, was devoted exclusively to Panama. Hay and Moody presented their latest consular dispatches, inaccurately reporting peace, stability, and rejoicing all over the isthmus. A cable from Arango, Boyd, and Arias confirmed that Señor Felipe Bonavarría had been appointed there envoy extraordinary in Washington, with full powers to conduct diplomatic and financial negotiations. For Bonavarría, sitting on his money in New York, that title was not yet good enough. There was no doubt what the junta wanted, diplomatic recognition of the Republic of Panama. Roosevelt and Hay were willing to extend such courtesy, now that the entire width of the isthmus had been secured. The delicate question was when. A prompt announcement might forestall any attempt by Colombia to reclaim the isthmus with a much larger military force. Panama, organized and recognized, could legitimately ask for American aid in repelling foreign invaders, and 7 American warships were on hand to comply. All the same, there was such a thing as indecent haste. Questions were being asked in British newspapers about Commander Hubbard's denial of transit rights to the Tiradores. Roosevelt did not feel the world as a whole would long deplore their repatriation to Barranquilla. All his readings in history and geography, all his thrusting Americanism, every consideration of international morality and expediency, told him that after 400 years of dreams and 20 years of planning, the Panama Canal's time had come. Colombia was clearly guilty of fatal insolence. Panama deserved the thanks and support of other self-determinant nations for her most just and proper revolution. Shortly before lunch, the cabinet meeting broke up. Hay returned to the State Department and cabled a message to Consul Ehrman in Panama City. The people of Panama have, by an apparently unanimous movement, dissolved their political connection with the Republic of Colombia and resumed their independence. When you are satisfied that a de facto government, Republican in form, and without substantial opposition from its own people, has been established in the state of Panama, you will enter into relations with it. The time was 12:51 p.m. The infant republic had been in existence not quite 67 hours. Roosevelt adjourned to lunch. One of his guests was Oscar Straus, whose understanding of international law, commerce, and diplomacy increasingly impressed him. Musing aloud, Roosevelt wondered about the validity of the 1846 treaty, in that it had been contracted with New Granada. Did American obligations to an extinct federation still apply in 1903? Straus suggested that the treaty was contracted only with the legitimate holders of the isthmus. American rights related to the territory, which was unchangeable. Our claim must be based upon what is known in law as a covenant running with the land. Roosevelt seized upon the words with delight. That evening, an announcement of provisional recognition of Panama, issued by the Secretary of State, quoted Strauss's dictum. Hay was careful to add the phrase, as lawyers say, and equally careful to eschew any reference to himself. His first words were, "The action of the President in the Panama matter," and he identified Theodore Roosevelt no fewer than 16 times in the next 20 paragraphs. The imperative demands of the interests of civilization required him to put a stop to the incessant civil contests and bickerings, which have been for so many years the curse of Panama. Professor John Bassett Moore was pleased to see some of his own language in the announcement, and sent Strauss a note of mutual congratulation. Perhaps, however, it is only a question of the covenant running away with the land. Chapter 19. The Imagination of the Wicked. A man can be right and be president, but he can't be both at the same time. After 22 years in politics, Theodore Roosevelt was used to critical noise, but the uproar following the recognition of Panama threatened even his robust eardrums. Loudest of all were the cries of Oswald Garrison Villard in the New York Evening Post. "This mad plunge of ours is simply and solely a vulgar and mercenary adventure, without a rag to cover its sordidness and shame. At one stroke, President Roosevelt and Secretary Hay have thrown to the winds the principles for which this nation was ready to go to war in the past, and have committed the country to a policy which is ignoble beyond words." If Villard meant the strictures of Abraham Lincoln against secession, Roosevelt could cite an earlier principle fought for by George Washington. Panamanians now, as Americans then, were tired of paying taxes to a remote autocratic government that invested nothing in return. He would have counted himself criminal as well as impotent had he not defended the revolution. But a time to reply would come. For the moment, his protesters had the floor. In tones approaching libel, Villard denounced the indecent haste with which Roosevelt had betrayed trust just for a handful of silver. Columbia had not rated so much as a warning. "It is the most ignominious thing we know of in the annals of American diplomacy, and this blow below the belt is dealt by the vociferous champion of fair play. This overriding of the rights of the weaker is the work of the advocate of a square deal. The preacher to bishops has shown that, for him at least, private morality has no application to public affairs. If the President is careless of the national honor, and ready at a word to launch us upon unknown seas, the duty of Congress is but the more imperative. Let this scandal be thrown open to the public gaze." Villard's attacks continued for several days, until even the doubtful demurred. "I rather hope you will continue to pitch in to Roosevelt," one reader wrote, "but as a matter of constitutional and international law, he was fully justified in all he did last week." Columbia had received ample warning from Panamanians, if not from Roosevelt. She had been too cowardly or too corrupt to fight. Roosevelt was bound to recognize her usurper, as other presidents had accepted the obsolescence of New Granada. Nor could he be blamed for moving quickly, along with Britain, France, and Germany. Nations must strike when irons are hot. Anti-imperialists, who had been starved of an issue since the end of the Philippines War, would not be quieted. "Nothing that Alexander or Nero ever did had a coarser touch of infamy," William Henry Thorpe wrote in The Globe. "And all the depredations of England, in Ireland, in Africa, or India, have been gentlemanly compared with this sleek and underhanded piece of national bank robbery." The Chicago Chronicle worried about the distrust which we shall hereafter inspire among South and Central American countries. Homer Davenport, cartoonist for the New York American, sketched a majestic eagle with a tiny isthmus-shaped animal dangling from its claw. However, 75% of the nation's more conservative, if less strident, newspapers supported Roosevelt. "Columbia has simply got what she deserved," the Pittsburgh Times commented, in words echoed by many. The Chicago Tribune agreed with John Hay that The action of the President was the only course he could have taken, in compliance with our treaty rights and obligations. Roosevelt's new vision of the Isthmus, said the Baltimore American, would inure to the advantage of the whole world. Democratic and independent editors vied with Republican ones for expressions of relief and satisfaction, albeit qualified. Even if the United States fomented the revolution, the Buffalo Express remarked, it acted in the interests of the governed. South American reactions turned out to be surprisingly muted, with fears of a foreign protectorate in Panama, tempered by pleasure at the prospect of a new commercial age. Very few newspapers saw evidence of United States involvement in the revolution. The change is to be welcomed, no matter how it has been brought about, said the Chilean Times. Even in Bogota, El Relator published a litany of Colombia's sins against her separated citizens. We have converted the lords and masters of that territory into pariahs of their native soils. We have cut their rights and suppressed all their liberties. We have robbed them of the most precious faculty of a free people, that of electing their mandatories, their legislators, their judges. In Europe, as in the United States, there was a preponderance of praise over dismay. The Times of London called Roosevelt's attitude studiously correct and expressed little sympathy for Colombia, the most corrupt and retrograde republic in Central America, which is saying a good deal. Conservative newspapers in both Britain and France marveled that the legislators of Bogota had tried to milk a treaty that would have brought one-fifth of the world's trade to their shores. Only in Germany was fear expressed of Roosevelt, the master expansionist. He is the type of advancing Americanism, as clever as he is unscrupulous, as powerful as he is sly. The president himself remained unruffled by all the fuss. A British visitor to the White House on 11 November found him absorbed in tittle-bat, tittle-mouse. On 13 November, a small man in brand-new diplomatic uniform paid a visit to the Blue Room. Secretary Hay presented him to Roosevelt as His Excellency Monsieur Philippe Bonavarria, Envoy Extraordinary and Minister Plenipotentiary of the Republic of Panama. Bonavarria bowed, handed over his credentials, and begged permission to read a short discours of his own composition. It owed its brevity to Hay, who had edited out many Gallic metaphors, likely to threaten the president's composure. But Bonavarria managed to mix a few more, after Roosevelt joked, "What do you think, Mr. Minister, of those people who print that we have made the revolution of Panama together?" "It is necessary patiently to wait," Bonavarria replied, "until the spring of the imagination of the wicked is dried up, and until truth dissipates the mist of mendacity." Afterward, with Hay, Bonavarria was all business. The United States must take advantage of his accreditation, as he would be unable to represent Panama for long. Already, a delegation headed by Dr. Amador was reported to be en route to Washington for treaty consultations. That could mean endless Hispanic haggling. Hay understood. "I shall send it to you as soon as possible." What Bonavarria received 2 days later was a slightly altered version of the old Hay-Iran treaty, allowing for a $10 million indemnity and an annual rental of $250,000. Although these amounts were clearly fabulous to an impoverished little Isthmian republic, the term struck Bonavarria as otherwise being not generous enough toward the United States. He wanted the quick approval of the United States Senate and felt that he should add inducements, such as a concession of sovereignty en bloc. A presidential election year loomed. Democrats and anti-Roosevelt Republicans were looking for an opportunity to humiliate the administration. Working through the night, with only 2 hours' sleep, Bonavarria sent Hay the next day a new protocol, markedly more in the interest of the United States. "Simply a suggestion to enable you to decide," he wrote. On 18 November, he received a return message. "Will you kindly call at my house at 6 o'clock today?" The secretary was unwontedly formal when Bonavarria presented himself. I have requested Your Excellency to be so good as to keep this appointment, in order to sign, if it is agreeable to Your Excellency, the treaty which will permit the construction of the Interoceanic Canal." He produced two beautifully typed copies, and waved aside an insignificant question of terminology in Article 2. "If Your Excellency agrees to it, the treaty will now be read, and we will then sign it." Conscious that Dr. Amador might at any minute knock on Hay's door, Bonavarria was quite willing to forego the reading. He had not thought to bring a seal, so the secretary offered him a choice of sealing rings. Bonavarria chose one embossed with the Hay coat of arms. The clock stood at 6:40 p.m. Pens scratched across parchment, wax melted on silk. Two oceans brimmed closer, ready to spill. Bonavarria was at 6th Street Station 3 hours later to greet the diplomatic delegation. "The Republic of Panama is henceforth under the protection of the United States," he announced as Dr. Amador stepped down, followed by Pablo Arosamena and Federico Boyd. "I have just signed the canal treaty." Amador reeled with shock. Bonavarria felt obliged to support him. "Cherish no illusion, Mr. Boyd. The negotiations are closed." Thanksgiving approached with lowering skies and shortening days, but Capitol Hill was lit up again weeks earlier than usual. The 58th Congress had convened in special session at Roosevelt's request. That looked like the extent of its obedience, at least until its regular session began in December. The dragging 18-month-old question of Cuban reciprocity, incredibly not yet resolved by last March's treaty approval, lacked the romantic appeal of gunboat diplomacy on the Spanish Main. Yet for political scientists, usually more interested in data than drama, there was much logistical fascination in the increased power of the House. Thanks to the census of 1900 and the election of 1902, a record apportionment of 386 representatives now crowded the lower chamber. 120 were freshmen, and more than half of those were Democrats, but the Republican total was still large enough for the new speaker to wield a formidable majority. Moving fast while Senate leaders took up the Panama Treaty, Joseph Cannon played host to a stream of callers, lavishing them with large confidences and small cigars. "I believe in consultin' the boys," he said, in the hayseed accent he liked to affect, "findin' out what most of 'em want, and then goin' ahead and doin' it." What the boys, that is, Uncle Joe himself, wanted was to remind the Senate of his famous threat about the right of the majority to rule. On 19 November, the House voted overwhelmingly in favor of a reciprocity bill for Cuba, based on the Senate's own treaty terms. Nothing remained but due process to make it law, whereupon the senatorial beet sugar lobby maneuvered for adjournment in order to mount a filibuster during the regular session. Cannon pointed out that if two houses were needed to pass a bill, two houses were also needed to vote for adjournment. As far as he was concerned, the special session could run on through its statutory limit on 7 December. Senators from remote states were thus denied a Thanksgiving vacation, while the speaker laughed at their discomfiture, ash peppering his vest. Mark Hanna, who had been noticeably subdued since coming back to town, went to spend the holiday in New York at the home of J.P. Morgan. His uncharacteristic quietness was caused partly by exhaustion and partly by a new strain on his relations with the White House. The president had offended him by asking him to manage the Roosevelt campaign of 1904. If that was a ploy to head off any last chance of a Hanna candidacy, it was a remarkably obvious one, insulting to the senator's intelligence. All Hanna wanted to do was enjoy the afterglow of his triumphant re-election. If the glow was intensified, for the moment, by electric light bulbs spelling out Hanna for president in Cleveland and New York, he saw no harm in a little celebrity before making a final disclaimer. Roosevelt should know by now that he had no further ambitions. He was tired, he told George Cordeliu, of going to the White House with his hand over his heart and swearing allegiance. Morgan, no less perceptive than the president, talked throughout Thanksgiving dinner of Hanna's duty to the country. He spoke not only for himself, but for all the Wall Street money men still recovering from the summer panic. The Pennsylvania Railroad's yards were crowded with empty cars. Morgan's Pride, U.S. Steel, had reduced wages sharply. As a result, millworkers and boilermen from Rhode Island to California faced an impoverished winter. Miners were rioting in Colorado. Theodore Roosevelt, seeking with one hand to constrict capital and with the other to throttle organized labor, was to blame. Financiers mistrusted what Oswald Garrison Villard called Roosevelt's terrifying habit of suddenness, demonstrated so recently in Panama. They looked to Hanna, a businessman as well as a senator, an employer well respected by working men, to save the Republican Party from schism. When the senator remained silent, Morgan appealed to Mrs. Hanna. It would be easy to nominate her husband, he said, if he would only give the word. She replied with feminine forthrightness, nothing would induce Mark to run. This did not stop Hanna from joshing reporters afterward. You can say what you damn please, he told them, grinning and thumping his cane. The senator's continuing conservative appeal exasperated Roosevelt, who thought it had been disposed of at Walla Walla. He saw trouble with Hanna in the months ahead, particularly with regard to party patronage. There was the vexed question of Dr. Crum, and a much newer one concerning Leonard Wood. Roosevelt wished to make his old Rough Rider commander a major general at 43. Unfortunately, Wood had once jailed one of Hanna's political cronies for postal fraud in Cuba. The senator was now bent on revenge. Nothing would better demonstrate his renewed legislative clout than blocking an obvious piece of presidential favoritism. In a last-minute effort to negotiate a truce, Roosevelt summoned Hanna to the White House on the evening of 4 December. They sat up till nearly midnight. Hanna won the right to say what he liked about Wood on the floor of the Senate, in exchange for permitting the appointment. Roosevelt also promised not to force the senator to serve another term as chairman of the Republican National Committee. In theory, this cleared Hanna to run for the presidency, but Roosevelt could see at close quarters that he was an exhausted man. Another party elder who had to be wooed before the regular session began was the priestly George F. Hoar. Roosevelt needed him to bless the administration's Panama policy as a sign to anti-imperialists, a dwindling but still powerful faction in Congress, that God had not been mocked on the isthmus. He invited the senator to take an advance look at his third annual message. Hoar began to read the Panama section, then stood up in disgust. I hope I may never live to see the day when the interests of my country are placed above its honor, he said, and walked out of the White House. Roosevelt turned to his two closest aides for counsel and got only wisecracks. I think, Philander Knox teased, it would be better to keep your action free from any taint of legality. Elihu Root was even more sarcastic. You have shown that you were accused of seduction, and you have conclusively proved that you were guilty of rape. Both men rallied behind him, however. Knox provided a written opinion, sovereignty over the isthmus as affecting the canal, which showed that the United States had legal grounds for her recognition of Panama, and Root came up with an ingenious argument to protect recess appointments from Speaker Cannon's forelengthening of Congress. Since the special session was by definition different from the regular, there must be a moment, no matter how infinitesimal, between them. This interval could be defined as a constructive recess, occurring neither before nor after, but precisely at noon, on 7 December 1903. As long as the President specified that time and date on all his commission sheets, he could reappoint Dr. Crum without Senate approval. Senator Tillman might fight the case all the way to the Supreme Court. In the meantime, Charleston would keep its black collector. It was counsel like this that Roosevelt dreaded losing in the new year. Whenever I see you or Root under the weather, he told Knox, I sympathize with Mr. Snodgrass when he beseeched Mr. Winkle for his sake not to drown. I am enabled to lay before the Senate a treaty providing for the building of the canal across the Isthmus of Panama. The section of the President's message that George Hoar had bridled at was read aloud to Congress on 7 December. Roosevelt wrote with evident confidence that Hoare's colleagues would ratify the Hay-Bonavarria Treaty, already endorsed, albeit angrily and reluctantly, by the Panamanian government. He reviewed United States-Colombian relations since 1846, showing how successive secretaries of state had interpreted the old Treaty of New Granada, always in the interest of free, neutral transit across the isthmus. He quoted Lewis Cass, "Sovereignty has its duties as well as its rights, and none of these local governments should be permitted, in a spirit of eastern isolation, to close the gates of intercourse on the great highways of the world." With no hint of irony, he also quoted William Henry Seward on the need of the United States to maintain a perfect neutrality in connection with political disturbances south of the border. He cited Attorney General James Speed's opinion that Washington was obliged to defend the isthmus against other and foreign governments. For more than half a century, the United States had behaved honorably toward Colombians, favoring them, indeed, by electing not to dig in Nicaragua and in drawing up the first canal treaty at their request. The Colombians had then repudiated it in such a manner as to make plain that not the scantiest hope remained of ever getting a satisfactory treaty from them. As a result, the people of Panama had risen literally as one man. "Yes, and the one man was Roosevelt," said Senator Edward Carmack. The president proceeded with his usual list of local riots and rebellions since 1850. He noted that on 10 occasions, 4 times at Colombia's request, American soldiers had been obliged to protect transit, life, and property. He scornfully quoted yet another request, just received, for the United States to crush the Panamanian Revolution, so that President Marroquin could declare martial law and approve the old treaty by decree. Under such circumstances, the government of the United States would have been guilty of folly and weakness, amounting in their sum to a crime against the nation, had it acted otherwise than it did when the revolution of November 3rd last took place in Panama. This great enterprise of building the interoceanic canal cannot be held up to gratify the whims or the even more sinister and evil peculiarities of people who, though they dwell afar off, yet, against the wish of the actual dwellers on the isthmus, assert an unreal supremacy over the territory. The possession of a territory fraught with such peculiar capacities as the isthmus in question carries with it obligations to mankind. The course of events has shown that this canal cannot be built by private enterprise or by any other nation than our own. Therefore, it must be built by the United States. The comments of congressmen afterward suggested that they were waiting to see how the American people reacted to the president's message. "I don't know what's in it," said Representative William P. Hepburn of Iowa, dodging reporters. Within a few hours, a largely favorable wind of opinion had begun to blow, and both parties adjusted sail. Senator Hoare alone refused to join his Republican colleagues in supporting the Hay-Bonavarria Treaty. He cited the recent remark of another former Secretary of State, Richard Olney, "For the first time in my life, I have to confess that I am ashamed of my country." Roosevelt, congenitally unable to question the rightness of his own decisions, did not understand what Hoare and other moralists meant when they talked of conscience in foreign policy making. If conscience was something more lasting than emotion, more flexible than intellect, he could do without it. He did not regret what he had done, because it was done. Second thoughts were like grief. They inhibited the vital onrush of life, of the world's work. He only knew that opportunity, Senator Ingalls's master of human destinies, had knocked unbidden at his gate. "It is the hour of fate, and they who follow me reach every state mortals desire, and conquer every foe save death." "In this Panama business," Roosevelt exploded to his son Ted, "the Evening Post and the entire fool mugwump crowd have fairly suffered from hysterics, and a goodly number of senators, even of my own party, have shown about as much backbone as so many angleworms." Quick to emasculate his critics, he dismissed the liberals of New York and Massachusetts as a small body of shrill eunuchs. He kept such expressions private, yet the violence of his language betrayed fear that the eunuchs would revive his old reputation for impulsiveness. Since the Northern Securities suit, he had worked hard to persuade party professionals that he was both conservative and cautious. His impartiality in the coal strike, his quiet management of the Venezuela crisis, his voluntary abandonment of antitrust activities, his insistence on the open shop in government, these were hardly the policies of a radical. Yet here was Villard still berating him as a rash young man, and a Wall Street consortium pledging $1 million to make Mark Hanna president of the United States. The Republican National Committee was about to meet in Washington to make its first plans for 1904. Then, Philander Knox and attorneys representing the Northern Securities Corporation were to present their final arguments before the Supreme Court. Should either of these confrontations embarrass the administration, Roosevelt's hopes of another term could crash. On 9 December, Walter Wellman was admitted to the executive office and given a major scoop. He reported it the next day in front-page articles in the Philadelphia Press and Chicago Record Herald. Washington, December 9. President Roosevelt has refused to make peace with the Trust and Railway Corporation leaders of New York. They approached the president with an offer to withdraw their opposition to him if he would give them certain assurances as to his future course. The president declined point blank. Angered by this rejection, the big financiers started a last desperate movement designed to bring Senator Hanna forward as a candidate for the Republican nomination for president. This, too, has failed. Mr. Hanna is not willing to become a candidate with the backing of Wall Street and the support of the Lily Whites of the South. These important disclosures, which I am able to make on the highest authority, explain much that has been going on above and beneath the surface during the past month. Wellman said that the president's importuners had represented J.P. Morgan, E.H. Harriman, James J. Hill, and the Rockefeller-Gould combination. They were afraid he was a warmonger as well as a trust buster. He might wreck the country any morning before breakfast. Hanna, fortunately, was no alarmist. As for Roosevelt and administration leaders, they do not believe the judgment and level-headed common sense of the American people can be upset by such methods. The article, reprinted widely, was the talk of Washington on 11 December, when 52 Republican bosses convened at the Arlington Hotel. Hanna escorted them to the green room of the White House after lunch. "Mr. President, I have the honor to present en masse the members of the Republican National Committee." He and Roosevelt stood side by side, with a mirror behind them, facing a semicircle of respectful faces. The committee men could see the bald back of Hanna's head in the glass, his arthritic stoop beside the president's bursting virility. There was an awkward pause. "Hanna, you had better pass around the room, Mr. President, and shake hands with each one." Roosevelt, "All right, I was just wondering which was the best way to get at them." Hanna, "You will have no trouble. They are all anxious to see you." Roosevelt, bowing, "I have sat at the feet of Gamaliel." Laughter warmed the room as he made his circuit. 2 days later, the committee came out of conference and expressed almost unanimous support for the president. As an endorsement, it was neither binding nor, indeed, expressed with any particular enthusiasm. But clearly, Gamaliel had laid down his staff. On 14 December, Knox put on a brilliant performance before the Supreme Court. Edith Roosevelt was there to watch and listen for her husband, along with Lodge, Spooner, and Moody. The little attorney general spoke calmly, piling premise upon premise with plump smacks of fist into palm. He argued that any obstruction to interstate commerce, whether it be a sandbar, a mob, or a monopoly, could and should be removed by the government. The Northern Securities Company was obstructive in that it had the effect, if not the technical title, of a trustee arrangement, uncontrollable by individual states. Although the justices listened impassively, Oliver Wendell Holmes, slouching, silky-mustached, on the extreme left of the bench. Most observers felt that Knox's argument was unanswerable. Roosevelt was overjoyed. This boded well for a favorable decision in the spring. In other good news, Nicaragua became the first Latin American nation to recognize Panama. All the world's major powers had already done so, except Britain and Japan, and their announcements were due at any moment. Further presents crammed his presidential stocking. The Senate voted for Cuban reciprocity, 57-8. G.P. Putnam's sons confirmed a $30,000 contract for the publication of a new edition of The Works of Theodore Roosevelt, in 14 volumes. Another $30,000 was deposited to his account in New York at the bequest of a deceased uncle. Although the most cash the president generally saw was what Edith put in his pocket, he understood that in his 46th year, he was beginning to be rich. Better than money, his greatest dream in life seemed more and more realizable. According to the New York Herald, 23 states had already pledged him 496 votes at next June's Republican National Convention, 11 more than he needed to be nominated, and 10 months remained for him to persuade the American people that he was no longer his accidency, but a substantial statesman deserving their vote of confidence. The 17th of December, 1903, was a work day much like any other for Roosevelt. He faced, at carefully timed intervals through the morning, a newspaper owner from upstate New York, a counsel to the Hague Tribunal, a consul from Shanghai, an aspirant postmaster from Missouri, an old hayseed from Oklahoma, the secretary of the Postal Progress League, the Attorney General of the United States, two doctors, three reverends, six senators, 15 railway inspectors, and uncounted congressmen. At 1 o'clock he was to conduct his usual barbershop levee. Root, Lodge, and Cordelieu were scheduled to join him for lunch, along with Winthrop Murray Crane. There would be precious little time for exercise in the afternoon, since he had bills to sign and letters to dictate, and appointments every hour until 6 o'clock. Then he must play bear with Archie and Quentin, spend some time with Edith, and dress for the cabinet dinner. And the Odells and Mellons would be staying the night. While Roosevelt talked to the consul from Shanghai, two brothers on a windswept beach in North Carolina shook hands. Then one of them lay down beside some covered ribs in front of a propeller motor. It sparked to life. Tremulous and spindly, a matchbox of spars and muslin accelerated along a rail and stepped into the air. Its wings rippled on an invisible swell, like wet leaves on water. The swell surged to 10 feet, then 15 feet, before gently subsiding. Ecstatic, the flying machine kicked off and soared, again and again and again. Chapter 20. Intrigue and Striving and Change. When he does any talkin', which he sometimes does, he talks at the man in front of him. You don't hear him hollering at posterity. Posterity don't begin to vote till after the polls close. Henry Adams attended Roosevelt's annual diplomatic reception on 7 January 1904 and was disturbed by signs of a developing autocracy, to say nothing of a nervous system that seemed to be beyond self-discipline. The president accosted him with a war whoop and ordered him upstairs for supper. I was stuffed into place at the imperial table, opposite Joe Chamberlain's daughter. Root sat at the end of the table between us. We were straws in Niagara. Never have I had an hour of worse social malaise. We were overwhelmed in a torrent of oratory, and at last I heard only the repetition of I, attached to indiscretions greater than one another, until only the British female seemed to survive. How Root stands this sort of thing, I do not know, for it is mortifying beyond even drunkenness. The worst of it is that it is mere cerebral excitement of normal, or at least habitual, nature. It has not the excuse of champagne. The wild talk about everything, Panama, Russia, Germany, England, and whatever else suggested itself, belonged not to the barroom, but the asylum. When I was let out and got to bed, I was a broken man. Another veteran of quieter times visited Washington that month and found that it was no longer the genteel city he remembered. "I am glad to leave," Charles G. Dawes wrote in his diary after seeing both Mark Hanna and the president. "The air is full of intrigue and striving and change." On the afternoon of 27 January, Roosevelt sent a White House carriage and a company of cavalry to 6th Street Station. Crowds collected along Pennsylvania Avenue. Such trappings usually heralded a visiting head of state, although none had been announced. When the procession clattered and jingled back downtown, the carriage rode much lower on its springs. Inside sat an enormously corpulent man of 46, his jowls tanned and his mustache bleached by years of Pacific sun. He smiled with enchanting sweetness, waving a cushioned palm, his pale blue eyes squeezed between chuckling rolls of fat. He was the retiring governor of the Philippines, and now the successor to Elihu Root as Secretary of War, William Howard Big Bill Taft. Merely to look at him was to be warmed and impressed. Taft had none of Root's austerity or Roosevelt's restless energy. He lounged comfortably at any angle and spoke calmly in all circumstances. At 330 pounds, he was periodically drowsy from too much food. Yet he was not lazy. Once he got under way, he had the ponderous momentum of an elephant. His gestures were slow, but full of power. He bore with no complaint huge loads of work, and produced commensurately. Whether he dictated a document or wrote it by hand, the words flowed in their hundreds and thousands, bland but never specious, unsparkling yet clear. His was not the vocabulary of a calculating politician. Taft wrote, thought, and acted like a judge. The Supreme Court was his admitted dream. "As far back as I can remember, I believe my ambitions were of a judicial cast," he told a reporter after checking into the Arlington Hotel. He did not mention that Roosevelt had twice offered him a seat on the bench, and that he had declined only out of a sense of duty in the Philippines. Still less would the elephant allow that Mrs. Taft, perched small and determined in his howdah, was nudging him in another direction. The reporter, Kate Carew, of the New York World, asked, "Which would you rather be, Chief Justice of the United States or President of the United States?" Taft quaked with self-protective laughter. "Oh, ho, ho, of course I couldn't answer that question." He flushed with merriment, while she thought, "He must have been a very pink and white baby." "Who do you suppose," Miss Carew pursued, when the heavings subsided, "will be the Republican candidate for president this year?" "President Theodore Roosevelt," Taft boomed, puffing out his cheeks. "And who in 1908? "Oh," he said, smiling, "that is too far ahead. But I had read somewhere that perhaps you would be." Taft began to talk about golf. Two days later, the outgoing Secretary of War attended his last cabinet meeting. He appeared to be struggling with his composure, as Roosevelt thanked him for staying on until Taft could relieve him. Root had a public reputation of being the coldest proposition that ever came down the pike. But friends knew the warmth of his bottled-up emotions and the precision of his wit, which Owen Wister nicely described as humor in ambush. The crack about the president's culpability for rape was already part of administration lore, as was the cable Root had sent to Manila after hearing that Taft had taken a 25-mile ride. "How is the horse?" Roosevelt rambled on affectionately until Root stood up, unable to bear more. He crossed to Taft's left, symbolically shedding power. "Mr. President," he said. His eyes filled, and he stopped. It was the little parlor in Buffalo all over again. Then, however, Root had been taking charge of a young and nervous beneficiary. Now he was quitting a leader who could do without him. "I thank you for what you have been good enough to say, Mr. President. This, of course, has been the great chapter in my life." He could not go on. "You know, sir, what I would say." The following evening, Root attended a Gridiron Club dinner in his honor at the Arlington. Roosevelt was there, along with the full cabinet. Even Senator Hanna limped downstairs. A performance group threw satiric barbs. Taft, giggling and guffawing, prodigiously duplicated in mirrors around the room, was warned that he might catch cold in Root's chilly aura. If so, he must stand close when Mark Hanna finally swore allegiance to Theodore Roosevelt. The president's glow of joy would thaw him. Roosevelt and Hanna, separated by white linen and bowls of roses, laughed with the rest. But the latter looked far from happy. He ate and drank nothing, and there were dark smudges under his eyes. "How is your health, Senator?" somebody asked. "Not good." Hanna did not leave his bed the next morning, Sunday, nor on Monday, the 1st of February. The jingling cavalrymen rode down the avenue again, below his windows, escorting Elihu Root to the station. Taft was sworn in. An order went out for an extra-large cabinet chair to be built for the new secretary. Day followed upon icy day. It had been the whitest winter in decades. Washington lay locked under a glaze of hard snow. Children skated on the streets. Alice Roosevelt and her friend Marguerite Cassini went bobsledding together and competed for the attentions of Congressman Nicholas Longworth, rich, youngish, and sexily balding. Something about Alice's laugh, when she asked if Nick had ever proposed, made Marguerite say, "Yes, he has." The two girls began to see less of each other. Roosevelt took a new course of jiu-jitsu, lunched with Buffalo Bill, and sent a long tirade against the demoralization of scientific historiography to his latest intellectual playmate, Sir George Otto Trevelyan. He heard with relief that Mrs. Cox, the black postmaster of Indianola, Mississippi, had decided not to seek another term. In her place, he quietly appointed a white man. The newspapers reported that Elihu Root had made a powerful speech to an audience of New York Republicans, warning them that Theodore Roosevelt was not safe. "He is not safe for the men who wish to prosecute selfish schemes for the public's detriment. He is not safe for the men who wish the government conducted with greater reference to campaign contributions than to the public good." Applause. "He is not safe for the men who wish to drag the President of the United States into a corner and make whispered arrangements. I say that he has been, during these years since President McKinley's death, the greatest conservative force for the protection of property and our institutions in the city of Washington." When Root used the adjective conservative, conservatives listened. Private word came that Wall Street opposition was at last diminishing. "It has become almost flat for me to express to you my realization of all you have done for me," the president wrote Root. Late on the evening of 4 February, George Cortelyou came in with a shock bulletin. Senator Hanna had been diagnosed with typhoid fever. Roosevelt was at the Arlington Hotel well before 9 the next morning. Doctors barred entry to the sick room, but he stayed 10 minutes with Mrs. Hanna. The afternoon papers noted his pilgrimage, as did Hanna, who scrawled a trembly note. "My dear Mr. President, you touched a tender spot, old man, when you call personally to inquire after this A.M. I may be worse before I can be better, but all the same such drops of kindness are good for a fellow. Sincerely yours, M.A. Hanna, Friday P.M. The senator lay comatose for several days, then surprised Mrs. Hanna by reaching for her hand. "Old lady," he said, "you and I are on the home stretch." Half a world away, the Far East exploded into war. For months, State Department officials had known that Japan would not long tolerate Russia's expansionism in Manchuria and her designs on Korea. However, even John Hay was surprised by the ferocity and speed of the first attack on 8 February. Dispatches confirmed that Admiral Heiichiro Togo had virtually annihilated the Russian Oriental fleet in a single swoop on Port Arthur. On the 9th, reports of further naval attacks followed like claps of thunder. In under 12 hours, Russia's two biggest battleships were sunk, another seriously damaged, and four cruisers disabled or destroyed. Japan was now the superior power in the Yellow Sea. Minister Kogoro Takahira could hardly conceal his elation as he delivered the Mikado's proclamation of war to Hay. On 11 February, Roosevelt announced that the United States would remain neutral. Count Cassini, the Russian ambassador, was not consoled by Hay's expressions of sympathy. He knew that the president personally favored Japan. Marguerite and Alice became even more estranged. Unconscious, Mark Hanna drifted toward death. He had never paid much attention to the world at large. Panama was merely a crossroads of American commerce, the oceans but highways for American ships. The cosmopolitan curiosity of a Theodore Roosevelt, currently reading a study of Indo-European ethnicity in Italian, was beyond him. All he had learned in life was that industry created wealth, and wealth subsidized good government. He had not done badly in either field. He had made $7 million and a president of the United States. Hanna's horizon contracted. He knew nothing of the vigilance in the lobby below, the constantly shrilling telephone booth, the letter from Roosevelt. "May you soon be with us again, old fellow, as strong in body and as vigorous in your leadership as ever." Inert on the pillow, he looked as formidable as ever, porcine features firm, skin tanned from oxygen treatment. But in the small hours of Monday the 15th, his heart began to fail. Doctors worked all morning to stimulate life. They blew ether up his nose, poured champagne and whiskey and nitroglycerin down his throat, and pumped brandy into his abdomen in 8-ounce shots. Washington's political activity slowed to a halt. Congressmen quit their desks and joined the crowd in the Arlington lobby. At 3 p.m., when Roosevelt walked over again from the White House, Hanna's pulse rate was scarcely perceptible. It fluttered for 3.5 more hours, then stopped. Governors, generals, cabinet officers, and senators pressed sobbing out of the lobby into the freezing night. Even Nelson Aldrich cried, his face contorted with sorrow. On 23 February, after 9 weeks of debate, the Panama Canal Treaty came up for ratification. By now, most of the world agreed with John Hay that Roosevelt had followed a perfectly regular course in